do a little quick warm up this morning. I'm going to start a sentence and I want you to finish the sentence for me. So if there's a person in your life and they are always really calm under pressure, you'd say they're as cool as a... Very good. You know how the game works, right? So if you're given something to do and it's really simple, you go, oh, that's a piece of... You guys, I love it. And let's say that you've got a person in your life who's really impatient and they need to chill out. You say, hey, man, you need to hold your... Okay, confession. Patrick didn't know any of those. Not one of them. Not my confession. I'm confessing him, so I'm telling on him. I tried it this week. I was like, yeah, they'll know it. He goes, man, they're not going to know any of those. They knew all of them. So good job. Patrick knew none of those, reiterating that. Maybe you know this one. You say to someone, sticks and stones will break your bones, but words will
never.
That's right. And is that true or false? Absolutely, good grief, absolutely false. Couldn't be more untrue than that. That's something you just say when you're a kid and someone says something unkind, or maybe you like, I preferred this one, you say, I'm rubber, you're glue, whatever you say bounces off me and it. And I was thinking this week about that, if like that wasn't just a thing you said when you were a kid, but as an adult, if you're at work and your boss was being cranky, and you pulled that out, like, I challenge you and I want to hear about it. I'm rubber, you're glue, come on boss, here's the report. You know, so I'd love to probably be committed. You wouldn't get, you know, just fired. You would be sent to an insane asylum. They say something's wrong. But here's the thing I was thinking about this week. This is true. Words have a lot of power in this world. Words create worlds. Words can start wars, they can heal wounds. Words shape so much and define so much about how we view ourselves and how we value the world. The Bible says death and life are in the power of the tongue. You know that? And when we talk about living a legacy and leaving a legacy, this may be one of the strongest ways that we live and leave a legacy in this world. I wonder this, how many of you have held on to a note, could be handwritten, a birthday card, or a text message, or maybe saved a voicemail from someone in your life? And it wasn't just what they said, but it was who said it and the heart behind it. You got something like that? I've got a bunch like that. I've held on to them. But there was a voicemail. It was really precious to me. It was my mentors, my youth pastor, one of the people who most in my life helped me to love Jesus and to love other people. And he left me one of his final voicemails before he passed away in 2020. And I had hung on to it on my phone. I never deleted it, but recently I updated the software on my phone. Yeah, I was like 2 years behind updating software, and I did. And when it updated and rebooted, all my voicemails were gone, and I lost that thing. And I'm not getting it back. It's gone. Like, it's in my head. I kind of remember it. The words I remember, but the voicemail is gone. I have the last text message he sent me, and I backed that up. It's on my computer. It's not going anywhere. But in it, he just poured out blessing over my life. And I don't know if he was thinking about this. It was near the end of his life. He was sicker than he told us at the time. But I don't know if he was thinking about this or not, but what he said in that text message was something that my heart would need to hear over and over again in my life. And I go back to it and I hang on to it in moments where I feel like I'm done. Like I don't want to deal with this kind of pressure anymore. There would be an easier way. I'm ready to give up. And I go back to words that were shared by Dennis in my life and how they helped me to press on in those moments. Some words you hear, they're just kind of there and then they go. But the reality is, the truth is, a lot of us know this, our words have a life to them. They have a life. They carry a bit of a legacy. They can heal. They can harm. They can take a person to their knees, or it can call them up to life. And we're doing this real brief series about living a legacy, because everyone leaves a legacy. You leave a legacy. The question is, what kind of legacy are you going to leave? We don't want to be people who just pass on stuff. We want to pass on substantial things. We make plans for passing on our valuables to the next generation, but we want to be people who pass on values, the really important stuff. And I think the words that we speak and how we speak into people's lives and the words we speak over people are one of the strongest tools that we have in this world to pass on what really matters. And I want to propose to you today that the words that you use on a daily basis, all of the words, in the simple times and the times that you're not even thinking about it, how you speak over people and what you're speaking into their life will live far past that encounter and far past even you as God uses it to shape their lives. And I want to show you a story where that's true in the Old Testament, in the book of Genesis. Grab your Bible, turn to Genesis chapter 27. This is where we're going to be this morning. And this is it's a legacy story. It's a family story. And it is a very, very messy story. In the middle of this story, We're going to find God moves his promises forward through a family and in this world in spite of the mess that this family brings to the table. It's a story about a guy named Isaac, and he spoke a blessing and kind of a deranged blessing or a curse over his two sons. And the words that he spoke not only meant something in that moment, but it set the trajectory, it set the path of their life and for nations after them for years and years to come. And so the story that we're getting into, I want to catch you up real quick. Last week we looked at Genesis 15, and there was a man named Abram. Abraham, we said he was a model of faith because he was able to balance. He had trust in God, and he had doubts and questions, and they didn't have to be enemies because they were anchored to the character of God. And because of that, because both could be true at the same time, he's a model for what faith looks like. Well, he had sons, and one of his sons was named Isaac. And Isaac had sons that were fraternal twins, Jacob and Esau. And if you remember their story, just before where we are today in Genesis 25, when their mother Rebekah was pregnant with them, she had some pain and difficulty in pregnancy, and she turned to God and prayed, and God said this to her: two nations are in your womb. Two peoples will be separated from your body, and one people shall be stronger than the other. Big line here, and the older shall serve the younger. I don't know how it works in your house, but that's not normal. The older shall serve. I'm an older brother, and that was never true. My brother will tell you that. We're both in our 40s, and he will still tell you the older never served the younger. That it's usually the opposite that is true. And in this culture, what was true is that the firstborn received the inheritance. They received the blessing. They received the leadership. They received all the power, and everything belonged to the firstborn. But in this case, what we'll find is Esau was born first, if you remember this story. And the text says that Jacob came out right after him, holding onto his foot. Like, I was trying to get there first, but you beat me, right? And God said that it's Jacob, not Esau, that will receive the blessing. It's an upending of the way the things work in this world. And if you remember the story, the two brothers, Jacob and Esau, Esau grew up to be like this manly, tough and rough dude. He was a hunter. He loved to like cook steak, or he loved to cook, but he was a hunter, probably something like that. He probably had a pellet grill or a smoker or something like that. But he was the kind of guy that his dad really liked and admired. And so he was his father's favorite. And Jacob was a little quieter, and he was an avid indoorsman. That's a thing. Just want to get that out there for some people like me. And he was his mother's favorite. And we don't know why, but Rebekah just loved her son, and she stayed close to her son. The favoritism, though, expressed in this family is going to create a lot of problems as we get into the story. So you're in Genesis. You found chapter 27. Look at verse 1. It says, now it came about when Isaac was old. That's dad, remember. When Isaac was old and his eyes were too dim to see, that he called his older son Esau, and he said to him, my son. Son said, here I am. And Isaac said, behold, now I am old. I do not know the day of my death. Now then, please take your gear, your quiver, your bow, go out to the field, hunt some game for me, and prepare a savory dish for me such as I love, and bring it to me that I may eat it, so that my soul will bless you before I die. Today, I want to talk to you about the power of words. I want to talk to you about the source behind our words and about how important it is that we steward our words according to God's heart and God's will. And the first thing that we're just going to pull out of this story, if you're taking notes, write this down. Our words that we use can bless and they can break. Both can be true. Our words can bless and they can break. And we see this in verse 4. When Isaac calls Esau forward, he says, my soul is going to bless you. I'm going to give you a blessing before I die. And this is not just like a throwaway statement, like I want to give you a few nice words before I die that you'll remember me by. He's talking about giving the family blessing to who? The oldest or the youngest? To the oldest, which is not what God had called them to do or laid over them. And in this culture, a father's blessing was legally binding, and it was a spiritual kind of destiny. It was part prophetic word, and it was part like this is what you're going to inherit from me is all of this. And the key is that there are no takebacks. When the blessing is given, the blessing is given, and you can't change it. It is binding forever. Now, in verse 1, we were told that his eyesight had gone. He has gotten to a place where he cannot see clearly, and Rebekah, his wife, hears he has the intention to give Esau this blessing, And so she immediately, you see in the next few verses, turns to Jacob and says, we have to come up with a plan. Here's how you're going to deceive your father and trick him so that you get the blessing. Look at verse 27, skip down there. So Jacob is the he here. Jacob came close and he kissed his father. And when his father smelled the smell of his garments, he's dressed up in Esau's hunting clothes. He blessed him and he said, see, the smell of my son is like the smell of a field which the Lord has blessed. Now, here comes the blessing. You ready? Now may God give you the dew of heaven and of the fatness of the earth and abundance of grain and new wine. May peoples serve you and nations bow down to you. You be the master of your brothers and may your mother's sons bow down to you. Cursed be those who curse you and blessed be those who bless you. And this is a binding blessing that he is laying upon Jacob, and it cannot be taken back. It's rich and it's affirming. And if you pay attention to last week, it is a reaffirmation of the blessing given to Abraham in Genesis 12. You'll be blessed to be a blessing to the nations, and God will bless those who bless you and curse those who curse you. He's passing this on. It's full of promise. It sets the trajectory of Jacob's life, but it also sets something else in motion, because as soon as Jacob begins to leave that room from his father, it's like he exits out one door and coming in the other door is Esau, and he's come in and he's done everything his father asked him to do. He went out hunting, he caught game, he brought it in, he cleaned it, he prepared it, he got it all ready, and he's come in to serve it, and he's excited, he's thrilled, he knows what this means. I'm bringing my dad exactly what he wants. I know I'm his favorite, and I know he's about to give me what I have always wanted, my inheritance, and he's giving it to me now. And it says when he walks in the room, Isaac trembled violently in verse 33, because he realized he had blessed not the son he intended to bless, but he blessed Jacob, and he knows the blessing now is gone. He has nothing to give his favorite son. I don't know if you grew up in Sunday school, any Sunday school kids? I grew up in Sunday school, and I had this picture in my mind that Esau was a jerk. Did anyone else get that? For some reason, most of my life, I thought, well, Esau was really this crummy brother. He was just kind of a jerk. Reality is, I think he was heartbroken. I think he was in a deep place of grief. When you read the verse 34, it says, he heard the word of his father and he cried out with exceedingly great and bitter cries. And he said, Father, I mean, he's like on his knees. Father, bless me, even me also. And it's grief. It's like the sound of someone who is seeing the door slam on their life with no hope of it opening again. He says to his father, do you have only one blessing? And he knows he does. But do you have only one? Bless me, even me also, oh my father. So Esau lifted up his voice and he wept. Doesn't sound like a jerk. It sounds like someone who is absolutely devastated in this moment. So Isaac opens up and he begins to speak again. And it's another kind of blessing, but it's a twisted blessing. It is a promise of a future, but not one that is very promising. He tells him, you're going to live by the sword. You are going to survive, but it's not going to be good for you. It's going to be a really hard life for you. And now in verse 41, Esau bore a grudge against Jacob because of the blessing that his father had blessed him with. And Esau said to himself, the days of mourning for my father are near. He's about to die, and then I'm going to go and kill my brother Jacob. That's what's going to happen. So as soon as the heartbreak receives that twisted blessing, now his heart is filled with rage and hate for his brother. And it's hard to get the real sense and the gravity of this story when you're just blitzing through it. But I want you to see that the same words that blessed Jacob and set him on a course of hope and of prosperity in his life were the words that broke Esau. They filled one son with hope and put one on his knees, devastated about the course of his life, and turned brother against brother. And I want you to see this because it's not simply just a historical problem in one family in the Near East. It's not just a Bible situation, but it is an us problem because our words have that same kind of gravity and same kind of weight also. And when used in ways that break, that can leave a devastating legacy for those who are around us. Words aren't neutral. Words don't float away. They bless, they build, or they break people. That's why Proverbs says life and death are in the power of the tongue. It's why James in James 3 says the tongue or the mouth is like the bridle on a horse. It's this tiny little thing, or the bit on a horse, and it can control the entire animal. This forceful, powerful thing is controlled by the littlest piece, or it's the rudder of a ship, one of the smallest parts on the ship, but it sets the whole course and the whole direction. Or he says, James says, it's like the spark in a dry forest that sets the whole thing on fire. Our words have that kind of power to them. And that's not just like sayings that people have. That is the word of God about the power of our words. And if we could really own that, if we could really abide in that, it would be greatly important for us to ask the question, are my words words that give life or words that take life? Are they words that give grace and open doors for the grace of God to be seen and experienced? Or are they barriers to people experiencing the grace of God? Have I accounted for the weight of the words in my life? And I love Ephesians 4:29, because in some ways it just seems like a happy verse, like a say nice things verse. But I think in every way it's a legacy verse. It's an inheritance verse. It says, let no unwholesome or corrupt or tearing down kind of word proceed from your mouth, but only such a word which is good for building up, for edification, according to the need of the moment, so that it will give grace to those who hear. That means before you speak, you have to determine, will this bless or break? I think we speak way too quickly. Before you text, you ask, is this a thing that opens the door for grace or closes the door for grace to experience? Before you post something, you really begin to think and process, is this a thing that points people to Jesus, or is this going to push people away from trusting Jesus more? You surrender your words before you speak your words, because if the words of this one family and this one tent and this one place could divide nations for generations, then you better believe the words that you speak over your dinner table or in your office or in your classroom or in your text group have that same kind of power. It's not unique to them. That's the power of our words also. And you come back to Genesis 27 and you've got this picture where the power of the words that were spoken were devastating in consequences, but I want you to also see the source of those words, where they came from. Write this down before we get into it. Words reveal the heart. Words reveal the heart. Notice this in verse 5, Rebekah overhears Isaac's plan to bless the wrong son, to bless Esau. And when she was pregnant, in verse 25, it says she was going through something and she turned to who? She turned to God. But in this moment, when she hears that things aren't going according to what God had said or according to what she desired, she doesn't go to God. She doesn't pray. She didn't go to her husband. She didn't talk to him. She didn't call a family meeting. What she does is she begins scheming immediately. There's no pause. There's just deceiving. And verses 8 through 10, she goes to Jacob and says, this is how we're going to trick your father and get you the blessing that you deserve. Here's how we're going to get what we want. And Jacob, notice what he doesn't do is question by saying, but mom, this sounds a little shady. It sounds a little wrong. Don't you think that this is, should we talk about this? What he says is, what if I get caught? Then what's going to happen to me? It's not the fear of doing wrong. It's not the fear of causing harm. It's the fear of getting caught doing the wrong thing. Verse 12, he says, perhaps my father will feel me, and I will be as a deceiver in his sight, and I will bring upon myself a curse and not a blessing. By the time he gets to verse 19, he's over it. He goes up to his father and he lies straight to his face. He says to his father, I am Esau. That's me. I am Esau, your firstborn. I have done just what you told me to do. Get up, please sit and eat of my game so that you will bless me. And why does this happen? It happens because favoritism and posturing and untruth had spoiled the hearts of this family. It poisoned their hearts. You got Isaac, who was a man of God, who had had faith in God. He had walked with God. And yet, though he knew the word and the will and the way of God for Jacob to be the one that received the blessing, that's not what he wanted. And he's in his last days, and what he's thinking about is, I want my favorite meal, I want my favorite son, and I want things to go my way. Don't know why he thinks Esau is the best. Maybe he sees somebody he wishes he was or something he can't do anymore, but his favoritism had spoiled and poisoned his heart. Rebekah, maybe she saw herself in Jacob, or maybe she just knew the blessing and she wanted to be close to the blessing, but it caused her then to not turn to God. It caused her to take into her own hands the thing that she desired. Jacob wanted not to miss out on the blessing, or wanted what he wanted because he was ambitious. Whatever it was, he was led so quickly to pretend to be someone he wasn't to get the thing that he desired. And Esau, who had the broken heart, true grief, immediately began to allow outrage and hate to fill his heart, so much so that he says, as soon as my dad is dead, I'm going to go and kill my brother. Every word in this chapter flows out of poisoned hearts, out of the things that they've allowed to live there and remain there, and it's come out in their words. Remember Jesus said, right, what's in the heart flows out of the mouth, the abundance of the heart, the mouth do speak. So if my heart is full of pride, when I talk to you, I'm always going to be looking for a way to elevate myself in front of you, that I would be the more powerful person, the wiser person, the smarter person, the person who has the upper hand. If pride is allowed to remain in here, if fear is allowed to live in my heart and it's given a home, its own room, its own little chair in my heart, then I'm always going to be speaking in ways to secure myself, to provide for myself, to protect myself. If our hearts are full of bitterness, if we allow that to live there, then we're going to speak in words that wound other people. We're going to hurt them before they can hurt us. And that's why Psalm 139 is so important. It's a blessing and it's a prayer for us. It says, search me, O God. Make this your prayer. Search me, O God. Know my heart. Be honest about what's within me. Test me. Know my thoughts. See if there's any grievous way in me, and lead me in the way that is everlasting. Everlasting is huge here, because the place of change isn't just in the action. It's not just in the vocabulary. The place of true transformation is the place of the heart. I don't just need clean hands. I don't just need clean words. I need a clean heart, something only Jesus can give us, the one who promises, I'm the one who gives everlasting life. If we want to have words that bring life, we have to have the author of life living within us, purifying what's going on inside of our heart so that our words are changed. But it doesn't start with the words. It starts with the heart. Imagine this. What if Isaac and Rebekah had a marriage that was in tune with one another? They were open, and their marriage was surrendered to the Lord, and their hearts were in tune with the Lord's heart. They knew his words. He had given them very clearly his words, sometimes more than what we have. This is what's going to happen. That's what he told them in Genesis 25. What if they were surrendered to that? What if they called a family meeting? You know, what if Rebekah said, hey, hon, I heard what you said, and I wanted to talk about that. Because remember, God had called us to this. What are we doing here? What if they had that conversation and they called the boys in? What if Isaac had gone to Esau and said, son, it's a hard conversation, but son, we got to talk. You know I love you. I've always loved you, and I will always provide, and I will always cherish every moment we've had, but we got to have a hard talk. I know all the firstborns, they get the blessing. But God has called us to something different in our family. He has, and I know it's hard, but we got to trust God for his word, because his word is always right. It's always good. It's always faithful. It's always true. Is it going to be hard for you to accept? Yeah. Is it going to be awkward when you see the other firstborns getting their inheritance and you're serving your brother? It is, but we got to walk in obedience. And because they walk in obedience, maybe God's grace would abound in ways that they never would have expected, and maybe it would have been a balm over the pain, and maybe they would have experienced something good as a family. But as it was, instead, they took things into their own hands. They allowed the poisoning of sin in their hearts to come out in their words. And so God's will was still done. The wrong son, it wasn't that the wrong son got blessed. The right son got blessed. God said, Jacob will be blessed. And Jacob was blessed, but the way it happened brought about pain and devastation and a fractured marriage and brother against brother. It came about in the worst way possible, because people had hearts that weren't surrendered to God, and their words came out and brought all kinds of damage. Write this down. Third thing, words can echo for generations. These are things that didn't have to be a part of the story. They didn't have to be a part of the story. Jacob wasn't blessed by accident. It was God's intention. But here's the tragedy. The hearts, the actions, and the words of this family brought about the plan in the absolute worst way possible. And the ripple effects didn't stop in the tent. They went on for 1,000+ years. And you read about Jacob, his line is Israel, right? Esau, his line is Edom. And there was a rift, there was fighting, there was death, there was murder, there was devastation between Edom and Israel for over 1,000 years. You read about it, Numbers 20, Israel's coming out of slavery in Egypt, and they're trying to pass through toward the promised land, and they come to the land of what? Edom. And the Edomites come out with their army and say, you ain't coming through here. We know who you guys are. We're still mad about it, right? And they threaten them. You get to 1 Samuel, and Saul is fighting against the Edomites. You get to 2 Samuel, David is fighting against the Edomites. He defeats them, but they come back in revolt, and there's war, and there's devastation. You get to Obadiah, which is well over 1,000 years past that night in that tent, and God comes, and he's speaking a curse over the Edomites because of their history of continued vicious violence against the people of Israel. There is a history of violence woven into this story that all traces its way back to one family, one tent, what was in their hearts, and the words that came out of their mouth, and it devastated for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. Words that blessed a brother and broke a brother. One who got the blessing and one who got a twist of a blessing. Why? Because a father didn't have a heart in line with his wife and didn't have a heart in line with God, but said he had a heart for what he wanted. You got a mother who, she wanted what she wanted for her son, whether it was for him or for God's glory or for herself. She went about it in the wrong way, and she used words to cause other people to deceive. You got a son that said, I'll do whatever it takes to get the thing that I want, the thing that I deserve. You got a son that says, you know, I'm heartbroken, but now I'm going to turn to rage and I'm going to kill him. You got words that bless one and break the other because hearts weren't in tune with the heart of God, and the damage of it didn't stay in the tent. The damage of it had a, what, legacy. Same thing with our words. It's not like this is unique. Same thing with our words. Words don't stay in the moment. They rarely do. They set patterns. They have a life to them. And some of you who are parents, you know this. You know, the words that you speak over your children don't last for just that moment. They carry with them. In fact, we've probably learned this looking back at our family of origin, but the words spoken from generation to generation have a great influence in the way we see ourselves and see the world, don't they? And the words that we're saying in our moments of frustration or in our moments of pursuit or ambition or whatever it is, they have a life. They don't last and exist just in that moment. They carry on. And they will be the kinds of words that are then passed on from our children to their children. They have a legacy. Leaders, you can speak words of life and because you're surrendered to the Lord and to his will and his way. Christ is alive in you, so you can speak words of life and of joy and of humility over the people that you lead and create an environment of encouragement and an environment that is full of grace and truth and points people to Jesus. Or you can speak of races and criticism and judgment and beat the other people, and you can create environments of devastation and destruction because that's the way that you speak into those places. Friends, the advice that you give, the counsel that you give right now, it can take a person who is down on their knees and walk them back up into life, and it can echo through their life for decades and decades, like the words that Dennis gave me in that text message that I go back to in moments where I go, I just want to give up. I want to do something else because this is just too much for me. And I go back to these words that have a life and they carry me forward. This is a story that is specifically about God's sovereignty in spite of us, but it also is a story that when we read it, we see that words are like seeds, and once they are planted, they will bear fruit. They will grow good or they will grow harm in our life. And frankly, you get to choose the words that you speak. Like, that has not been abdicated to someone else. You choose the words that you speak, and I need you to hear this. Listen, I feel like we used to know this as a people, as a society, but we have somehow moved on far from it. You don't have to speak everything you think, okay? It's true. We used to know that. It just feels like it's been a long time since we lived there. I don't have to say everything that crosses my mind. In fact, I probably shouldn't, because not everything that crosses my mind is holy, right? But what I need to do is I need to surrender my mind. I need to surrender my heart and take account of the power of the words and the privilege and the responsibility that I have in bearing words. And I need to surrender my heart that I would have a heart that beats after God. Remember Galatians, I no longer live, but Christ lives in me, that my heart would be aligned with his heart so that the things that come out of me wouldn't be the things of Kevin, but the things of Christ that give life into a broken and a hurting world. I need to take account of that so that I could sow seeds that would bear up the kind of fruit that is pleasing to the Lord. Psalm 19:14 says, may the words of my mouth and the meditations of my heart be pleasing to you, O Lord, my rock and my redeemer. I want to ask you this, just like a little test for us when we think about how we use our words. Could you imagine if Jesus were standing right near to you? It's just a silly little test, but I think it's more than silly. I think it's significant. If Jesus were standing right next to you, and remember, if Christ is alive in you, he is there with you. He's present, right? If you're, do you not know you're the temple of the Holy Spirit, right? But if he were standing next to you and you could see his face, would you say the same words that you say on a daily basis when you go to work and when you speak to your kids and when you're watching the news or in the car or whatever? Would you send the same text messages? You know, would you, when you see that ridiculous, crazy post online, would you go and hop in the forum and start punching in the same way if you could look over and see the face of Jesus in that moment? Or would it change what you speak? If I no longer live, but Christ lives in me, boy, he's as present as it gets. He's more present than if he were across the room or down the street, right? If I'm a temple of the Holy Spirit who dwells within me, 1 Corinthians 6, then he is so very present. It really is a little bit of a gut check on, am I taking account of the weight and the gravity and the responsibility I have with the words that I speak with the people around me? May the words of my mouth, Lord, and the meditations of my heart be pleasing to you, O Lord, my rock and my redeemer. You know, we look at Genesis 27 and we can see the pain that our words can cause, but you know that the opposite is just as true. Like, some of you are here because you had a sweet granny who spoke blessing into your life every Sunday. You know, maybe it wasn't the family you grew up with and went to church with every Sunday, but granny was praying for you and you knew that, right? Or you had a coach or a teacher or a boss who was surrendered to Jesus. They loved the Lord. Christ was alive in them. And so they were able to speak blessing. They were able to speak words of life to you. Or you had a friend who, when you were going through something, said, listen, the Lord sees you. He is real. He comes near to the brokenhearted. He loves you. Lean into that. Experience that in him. Don't give up. And those words, they didn't just remain in that moment, but they became something that was a force in your life. It carried you through a season, and it echoes for seasons in your life. It's a legacy that's left on you. I was thinking about a story I heard one time about a man who kept a box in his top dresser drawer. And I have a box, like the box in the story, and it's full of scriptures and notes from people. It's full of prayers and little reminders from people. And in the story, the man, when he passed away, his kids were going through his things and they found the box and they opened the box and they started going through it. And what they found was that it wasn't simply a legacy box in terms of the things that he learned over his life, but really that his legacy was in them, because they weren't just scriptures and sayings and prayers that he had received, but they were those that passed through him onto his kids. They were things that he had spoken over them their entire life, things that they had begun repeating in their life to their own kids. And the reality is, every one of us one day we'll have people who are near to us throughout this life looking at our legacy box. And it's not slips of paper. It's the words etched on their hearts from the experiences that they had with us, the things that we said to them about God. And those words will carry weight. They will. I think you look at a story like Genesis 27, one, it's a story to worship the God in heaven who nothing will derail the plans of God. He has a beautiful plan and a promise, and we can't get in the way of that. But it's also a lesson that we want to be a part of what God is doing. and not be the ones that are frustrating, that are trying to destroy what God is doing simply because we don't have control of our hearts and our mouths and we haven't surrendered them to God. Let's be people who are committed to speak words that give life far past the moment. And the only way to do that is to be a people who lay down our hearts before the Lord to receive from Him. And that means the frustrations I carry, I'm carrying some broken heart right now. I'm carrying some deep frustration right now. And I've got some anxiety heading into this week that I'm carrying. The only answer is for me to lay those things at the feet of Jesus and say, Lord, would you transform these things? I don't want to pretend they're not there, but I want to entrust them over to you that you might make something of them that only you could do, so that this week I don't go out and speak out of frustration and speak out of exhaustion and speak out of anxiety, but I speak out of transformation. Let's be a people who leave a legacy of words with all of the people that we encounter. Can I pray for you? Father, I thank you this morning for your word, and it is beautiful to us how you have in your just wisdom and grace had these stories of history recorded, that they would not be only moments of things that happened, but they would expose us to the greater story of how you're working and how we are a part of that story. And I pray that we would learn the lesson of this family. We would learn that our words carry such weight, they have such power, and only when they are surrendered to you, only when we are surrendered to you, can we be a people who join joyfully in the thing that you're doing. So may we as individuals and may we as Legacy Church be concerned with passing along not just stuff but substance, that we would surrender our hearts and words to you, that those who encounter us and our families, our neighborhood, our workplaces of business, our schools, would know that something was different because of the words we speak, and it would be a direct line to hearts surrendered to you, and it would draw more and more people into the grace and more people into the love that you have to give. So I pray your mercy would be on us today. Pray that your grace would work in our brokenness. And I pray that you give us the courage and the strength to lay things down and allow you to transform them. In Jesus' name, amen.